Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that gives us an opportunity to meet people who have made a difference in our lives. This is Bob Willard, and we will be visiting today with Noel Paul Stuckey, songwriter, father of three daughters, husband of the Reverend Elizabeth Stuckey, and the Paul of Peter, Paul, and Mary. For the next hour or so, we will ask Noel a few questions, play some music, and meet the person behind the persona. Noel, welcome to Profiles.
Hey, thanks, Bob. Good to be here.
Glad to have you here.
Yeah, there's a lot of electric circuitry here.
Noel, let me remind our listeners of some of your accomplishments. I need go no further than mentioning some of Peter, Paul, and Mary's songs to put them, to put it in perspective. Puff the Magic Dragon, Blowing in the Wind, If I Had a Hammer, and Leaving on a Jet Plane are just a few of the super hits that have made this group so popular for 40 years. Now, Noel, let's start with the present. Though Peter, Paul, and Mary still tour, you're more likely to be found working with your wife, Betty, at Northfield Mount Hermon School in Northfield, Massachusetts. Can you fill us in on this aspect of your life?
Well, I'm not sure I can do that without making a transition from Peter, Paul, and Mary. I suppose the briefest way to put it would be that following the group's reunion in 1978, we all realized that we had been working entirely too hard the first 10 years of our lives, and we mutually agreed to do between 30 and 40 shows a year from there on out. Well, that was very manageable, although, you know, for people that don't travel, 30 to 40 shows a year sounds like an enormous amount. But in fact, we were doing over 200 shows a year in the early 60s. So 40 was like a vacation, and still is. It affords me some real quality time with my family. And whether that's my wife and I driving up north to Vermont to visit our year-old grandson, or whether it means that I have a Sunday available, a weekend available to be able to sing in chapel for Betty, all of these things are now possible where they wouldn't have been in the 60s.
Well, this facet of your life is relatively recent, and how did it come about?
Well, I certainly wouldn't be here on this Northfield Mount Hermon campus if it weren't for my wife of 37 years of marriage, who, amazingly enough, decided about 7 years ago that she would go to Harvard Divinity School. Initially, she thought just to gain some counseling skills, because she saw that the need among the high school kids to whom she was teaching French was far deeper than just language. But as many times it turns out, when she reached the end of 3 or 4 years, she wanted to be ordained, because she felt that that was a manner in which not only would she gain the credentials for counseling, but she would also be able to bring her sensitivity to, and her awareness, and her unique and particular perspective of God to adolescents. And when you know it, she got smiled upon, because in an unusual move, that is to say, for people who perhaps don't understand the amount of time following graduation from a seminary, or that it takes to obtain a job as a minister, Betty got one within 2 months, and it was on this campus of Northfield Mount Hermon. And so we moved here about 3 or 4 years ago, and I'm still pretty active, you know, as active as the group is. I do a lot of traveling, but on the times here, I've been able to be involved with Betty not only at the church services, but I've been an artist in residence, and have taught a songwriting class, and recorded a couple of the circumstances, because after 62 years, you're bound to learn something about tape recording if you've been in the music business for a while. So it's been a very gradual, very loving, and very exciting, and how shall I say, eye-opening experience for me, because all of those years in the early 70s and 60s, when Betty was taking care of the home fires, and I was out being Paul of Peter, Paul, and Mary, and every time we'd go to a party, and Betty had to endure being the Mrs. Paul, not the fish sticks, but of the trio, and now the shoe's on the other foot. and I am Mr. Chaplain, or the chaplain's husband, or, that guy that used to sing, but he's married to Stuckey. It's very refreshing, and somehow our relationship, you know, I think, to make a long answer even longer, I think every couple, every relationship yearns to do something together. And certainly they are in a loving relationship. There are many opportunities to do that, but not always in terms of your work. And here Betty and I are in the twilight of our years, you know, probably with 30 years left. We're working on projects together. It's a very exciting time in our lives.
Well, you're also the father figure for 1,100 teenagers, too.
Oh, believe me, there are a lot of administrators and teachers on this campus who are far, far more father figures than I am. I'm not that active on the campus. But, yes, I mean, I do love them, and I am available for them.
Well, you mentioned that you help Betty in the chapel. You write and perform music for the chapel services at the school. Isn't that correct?
Well, I've never written, I mean, very seldom have I written on demand. Usually, I just share the particular perspective that I have, whether the subject material is the equity of all faiths, or whether it's the using the metaphor, God's strongest metaphor, you know, which is love. I generally write from personal experience or personal desire, and I don't write worship music specifically for the chapel services. I just reach into that deep bag of about 30 years of songwriting and pull out a song for the particular occasion.
Well, you wrote the wedding song, right?
Well, in a sense, I wrote it. You know, I actually made a recording called One Night Stand where I spoke about songwriting and how there are times when the inspiration comes so fast and you have absolutely no idea where the song came from, and you just write it down, and isn't that cute, and isn't that clever, and isn't that weird? Then there's another category where you know precisely what it is you want to say, and you spend a great deal of time honing and shaping, and it comes from your personal experience. But I had never really experienced the third kind of song writing, which was really as a result of prayer. When Peter asked me to write a song for his wedding, I felt that the most important gift for his wedding would be the presence of God. And so I went into prayer and said, well, God, how would you manifest yourself at Peter's wedding musically? And then the words came and the music essentially at the same time, and I, you know, wrote as quickly and as accurately as I could. And it turned out that the song had a much broader application than just for Peter's wedding, but I didn't know that at the time.
Well, it's performed at weddings all over the world now, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. Do you have any in your neighborhood?
I have heard it in my neighborhood, both in California and here. So.
Yes. Well, you know, because I prayed for it specifically for Peter's wedding, I didn't perform it after the wedding in the context of a Peter, Paul, Mary tour until Peter came up to me, actually, and said, why aren't you doing the wedding song? And I said, well, Peter, you have to understand that was a gift for your wedding. I mean, that's what you asked for. And he said, yeah, well, I understand your reticence in doing it. He said, but my wife is in the audience, and she'd like to hear it. And that was the first performance. I think it was perhaps in Minnesota, even, where Mary Beth was from. And the moment that the shell was broken, and I recognized that this was speaking of a much larger wedding, you know, in a sense, the union of the human heart with its creator, then I felt good about just performing it in general. And so I have, for the past, 37 years? No, 30 years. And ironically, you know, the lyric that was given me in prayer was, I am now to be among you at the calling of your hearts. Rest assured, this troubadour is acting on my part in the concern that I might be viewed as trying to present myself as the second coming. I changed the lyrics to, he is now to be among you at the calling of your heart, never recognizing that in God's infinite wisdom that the gender issue would surface about some 20, 30 years later. And by the introduction of that pronoun, I just made the song less accessible to many of the believers. So I am now in performance and have for the past 3-4 years gone back to the original lyric.
Well, we have a copy of that that you're singing. Do you mind if we listen to it now?
No, of course.
Okay, let's do it. You have just heard The Wedding Song, written and performed by our guest today, Noel Paul Stuckey. Noel, Peter, Paul, and Mary, more than any other group, has carried on the tradition of the Weavers, John and Alan Lomax, Pete Seeger, and Woody Guthrie. How did all of this come about?
Peter and Mary and I count ourselves really blessed insofar as we've inherited this legacy from Pete Seeger and Josh White and Woody and Cisco Houston and so many other contributors to the sustaining of the caring community of humankind, which is really a long-winded way of saying that folk music stays alive because of the passions of the people who sing it. And I think we learned early on by those examples that the music doesn't have an authenticity unless you participate in the lyric content. And that meant marching, to protest the indignities suffered by the people who, had achieved civil rights only on the surface, but certainly not in the reality of the Deep South. That meant becoming the loyal opposition and crying out against a war in Vietnam that we had inherited from our allies. That meant taking certain stands on the environment. That active participation in the content of the songs, whether it's those three areas or visiting El Salvador to see firsthand the repressive government that was in operation at the time, or Mary's trip to in the aid of refusenik Jews when the Russians were stopping the refugees from leaving. The fact is their folk music is kind of a step beyond entertainment. I mean, it is entertaining to hear, and we certainly have had our fun with it. And we've also, I think, pushed the envelope a little bit. Peter and Mary and I have done, we do the children's songs, but we also do jazz pieces like What's Her Name, or we sing parodies or put-ons of our musical peers in the 60s with a song called I Dig Rock and Roll Music.
That's one of yours, isn't it?
and even today. We do contemporary songwriters' music, but all of it has a core of caring. All of it has a connection to the community of humanity. And we recognized when we got back together for the second two-thirds of our career that human rights is a much broader concept than just Selma to Montgomery. So that was an important and integral part of it and certainly a great introduction for us. It also includes a lot of other aspects of our shared human experience as a global community. We've learned a lot from the music, and we've kept true to it and contributed something back as well.
But you've kept that as a part of your own personal belief system, isn't anything that, well, you're concerned about upholding human dignity.
Yeah, but we're all students. You know, we didn't come into this world wise. And what a great instructor folk music was. I think that's the strongest point I'm trying to make, is that we were instructed by the music that we sang in many instances.
Well, much of what you inherited was protest music, too, and you just carried it on.
Well, they called it protest music, but it actually was affirmation music of another point of view.
Well, I've always, you know, when I was a fan of the Weavers, and then uh-huh. you all came on, and it was just a nice transition, and it was uh-huh. important to me.
Well, we did respect them and love them, and we had such a wonderful time singing with them. I don't know if you've had a chance to hear an album we did called Lifelines, where we sang with Pete and Ronnie and Freddie. Again, unfortunately, Lee Hayes had passed away, but, you know, it was really kind of an enactment of the passing on of the legacy.
Well, those are the writers of If I Had a Hammer, too, aren't they?
You got that right.
Yeah. Okay. And what's the group in Texas that you've been supporting? The Celebration Shop or whatever it's called.
Yeah, thanks for asking. It's a group of, it's now a group. At first, it was just a young Methodist minister by the name of Jim Newton who had a guitar around his neck and went into a couple of hospitals and discovered pretty forcefully, I mean, to the point of tears, that music could bring children out of almost catatonic states and reconnect them to the reality and joy of life, no matter how painful or how isolated their illness had caused them to be. And he started this organization with a young songwriter called Paul Hill. The two of them contacted me, and I produced their first group of cassette songs, which they gave away free through sponsorship down in Texas to about 30,000 children all over, started in Texas and all over the United States. The second project finished and received a family award as well, and we've just finished our third project, and the funding is beginning to roll in, so it looks as though not only will these be available to the children in the hospital where they originally intended, but as you know, Bob, or most any of us know, sometimes you know, a good deed doesn't end. It's not a one-way street, and some of it comes back, some of it spreads to the side. And songs about self-esteem are not necessary only for people in hospitals. In our own lives, we're looking for that kind of support and encouragement. And these songs really are quite broad in their appeal, though they certainly are for a younger audience. So we're thinking that with the additional funding, we'll be able to take it to a place like Toys R Us or, you know, Amazon.com and be able to reach and support and encourage a lot more children.
That leads me to a question going back in our, earlier in the interview. Mm-hmm. Didn't you give the rights to the wedding song to some charity?
Well, yes, it was an embarrassing position, you know. I mean, as I told you, there are three kinds of songs. I mean, there are probably more, but I tend to put them into three categories. And the first two that I described, even though the muse may strike me, I felt no compunction about putting my name next to it because I was the, you know, I was the point man for the inspiration. But in the case of the wedding song, where it was a prayed-for song and I felt that the inspiration was directed, you know, had a particular reason for its expression, I felt embarrassed putting my name down as the author because I had never been in such, you know, direct supplication before in terms of writing a song. So when it came time to record the song, of course, you have to have an author. You have to have a publishing company. So I didn't mind getting paid for my performance of the song, but I felt very funny taking any kind of money for the writing or the authorship or the publishing of the song. So all of that money was donated. I started a foundation called the Public Domain Foundation. And up to now, we're nearly at the $2 million mark. And we've touched a lot of lives with that money.
Just from that song?
Just from that song.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, it is, as you said, a very popular song, and every June, July, and August, it gets even more popular.
Noel, you seem to have a strong sense of the spiritual. What's the source of all that?
certainly a very gratified sense of an answer to a search that is in continuity, in perpetuity, but was answered in the late 60s for me. I was very aware, living the fast-paced life that I was in the context of the trio, that I was making decisions for all the wrong reasons and looking for love in all the wrong places. And I was fortunate enough to be very outspoken prayerfully, and God answered with three fellows backstage who told me about their encounter with a living God. And after some prayer that night and some weeping and confession that I had been so estranged from the possibility of actually having a dialogue with God, I mean, that was pretty overwhelming. My life changed completely. My subject material and my songs changed completely. I mean, in a funny kind of way, and I think this is very insightful, when Mary was asked by, I think it was Scott Ross from the CBN network, the Christian Broadcasting Network, how did Noel, you know, did you see a change in Noel after his conversion? She said, well, you know, I did, but it wasn't like he had changed. It's like he had gone back to the way he had been when I first knew him. And I think that's very revealing in terms of the fact that many of us who are hurting find the concept of innocence so far removed. How will we ever regain or reclaim the childish optimism and hope and wonder that we had until something wonderful comes along, like the opportunity to have a direct dialogue with God, ask for that immediate forgiveness, and get a sense viscerally, you know, both physically and spiritually, that you are heard and you are loved. And that was a major turning point in my life at, you know, at the age of 32 or 33, I guess it was, 1969, 1970. You know, even though I'm not perfect, as the expression goes, I do feel forgiven, and I do feel like I've been given a second chance to point my life in a much more altruistic and a much more rewarding direction.
Well, that certainly fits hand in glove with what Betty does, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Is there any song that you sent us that, how about Peace in the Valley?
Oh, yeah. Well, Peace in the Valley's got a funny verse in it, as a matter of fact. I mean, it has a wonderful thought, you understand. Before we can criticize somebody else, we better make sure that our own act is together. That's a way of paraphrasing the scripture. Before you tell a man he's got a splinter in his eye, you better pull the beam out of your own. And so I used that as a chorus, and ironically, I was asked down to sing on Jim Baker's television show. You remember the recently defrocked Jim? That third verse that says, so if you meet a man in a pastel suit, you know, it is so easy for people who consider themselves hip, au courant, to condemn the evangelical by their dress, and in such a hypocritical fashion, because I can remember in the late 50s and early 60s, we used to condemn the suits for condemning us wearing sandals and goatees. And I got to thinking, you know, we really need a reality check here, folks. And so that's why the surprising end to that verse happens. People, I think, when they initially hear, so if you meet a man in a pastel suit with an alligator Bible to match his boots, they think that I'm really going to go on a tear against people like Jim Baker or, you know, the more visible and outrageous evangelists. But as you heard, or as you will hear, the lyric has a funny little turn to it.
Thank you. There's a pigeon apiece in my backyard.
We have just heard Peace in the Valley, performed by Noel Paul Stuckey, our guest today. Noel is the Paul of Peter, Paul, and Mary. You mentioned off the air that this was, you have some pieces that were written before your conversion. Can you explain what you were or what you believed in before that?
I think many times God speaks to us in non-religious, non-churchy terms, and we have to be, open to a much broader dialogue. And a lot of people are surprised to hear that the song called Hymn that was done on a Peter, Paul, and Mary album was written pre-Christian, because it's so like Martin Luther nailing the note to the church door. It reminds us of our personal responsibility to discover and create a relationship with our Creator. All through my song life, I've been very fortunate to have these opportunities to make personal statements, which sometimes turn out to be statements that are helpful to somebody else. I do recall fondly and humorously a song. It was when I ended up doing it. In the early days of multitrack, you could sing with yourself immediately. That is to say, you could sing a melody and then wind the tape back to the top and sing on an entirely other track without obscuring or overwhelming the initial vocal. And then you could do that two or three times, or as the Beatles did it, they triple tracked Sgt. Pepper. They did the entire album on an 8-track machine. Well, I had an 8-track machine in my basement in the early 70s, and I did this funny little song called Don't Do That Dope Anymore and added three other voices to it. And it was exactly a minute long. I thought, this would make a great anti-drug statement if you wanted to have an announcer's voice over the top of it. And I took it into the studio and played it for some musicians that I was working with. And I must say that I was part of the recreational drug scene at the time as well. But I played this tune that I had done. And Michael, I remember Michael Lewis looking at me kind of severely and saying, I don't think you should lecture people like that. I wasn't even aware that it could be interpreted that way. I was just saying it personally, that I don't do that doing it. And he went, oh. And I realized that recreational drugs have a certain paranoiac level that was never more evident.
Could we take just a moment and listen to that one-minute piece?
One, two. Don't do that dope anymore. Don't do that dope anymore. Don't do that dope anymore. Don't do that dope. Don't do that dope anymore. Don't do that dope anymore. Don't do that dope anymore. Don't do that dope. Don't do that dope anymore. Don't do that dope anymore. Don't do that dope anymore. Don't do that dope. Don't do that dope anymore. Don't do that dope anymore. Don't do that dope anymore. Don't do that dope. Nope.
We have just heard Don't Do That Dope performed multiple times by Noel Paul Stuckey, who is our guest today.
You know, it's funny, Bob. Sometimes people, particularly in the Christian world, look at my writing as foolish. I can recall creating a piece on a flight back from a concert tour that I had done in Australia. And I was coming back just before Easter. It was April. And I was thinking that the apparent foolishness to the world of Christ's gift, His becoming a lamb so that we might see how to overcome death. it just inspired me so much to write a song called April Fool. And yet, it's sometimes difficult for people who have been brought up in traditional church circumstances to hear, because while the words are poetic and make obvious reference to even the washing of the hands by Pontius Pilate, it's all couched in jazz chords. And I think people have sometimes difficulty overcoming cultural predispositions to be able to hear the truth embedded in a song like that.
That's got to be tough, to be able to write it so that it speaks out beyond just what someone's prejudice might be.
Well, I think the burden is on the listener, frankly.
Well, I want to step back a minute to another area. I mean, we've called you Noel. You're known as Paul. And to your friend, Stuke.
There's some friend.
Okay. But there's also Sysop.
Sysop. Systems operator, yeah.
Yeah, and a name that reflects another of your loves and interests. Can you tell us about computers, electronics, sound, et cetera?
You know, most all of the creative process is hooked somewhere together. All emanates from a desire to create, to control, to pretend, if you will, for a moment that you have the same kind of power and authority that God has. And the first time I walked by a computer and accidentally hit the keyboard and a little blinking cursor came up and said, "Ready," I went, "What? What is this?" And it was such an invitation. I spent 3 or 4 months recovering from a broken leg programming in BASIC, an accounts receivable program for my wife's flower shop up in Blue Hill, Maine. I learned a lot about the computer then, and as the revolution kind of bent towards becoming a community again, you know, many inventions have their own little coterie of believers, but ultimately they have to blend into the human community or they're really not worth very much. And as high-tech began to speak through the telephone lines, I became aware of a real need on the part of a lot of people who were socially withdrawn and not very happy, who were sequestered away with their keyboards, and they had a desire to communicate, but they were not very good at it, you know, in person-to-person relationships, but they could hide behind their keyboards in the anonymity of the Internet. And so I took it upon myself, really, to kind of be a circuit rider, you know, if I can play with the term circuit board and the reference to the earlier ministers who used to ride between small towns in the mid and far west. And I found myself hosting a bulletin board that would have a lot of very disparate people dialing in from all kind of walks of life. I was like a host at this party. And the idea was to encourage them, caution them when they used bad language, when they when they were rude to each other. It was like being a camp counselor at for Boy Scouts. And eventually that little BBS disappeared because the Internet came along, and now to a large extent I suppose I've transferred all that interest into just if not shepherding, at least being a supporter of the Peter, Paul, and Mary website and my own website, which ultimately, each of us probably will have, where we can post our memoirs or recordings that we've made or photographs that we've taken. It's really a very communicative process and one that I really enjoy being a part of.
You mentioned something. Didn't you go to New York to be a photographer?
Well, not to be a photographer. I went to New York actually to meet girls. Have my own apartment, be independent, you know. It was pretty simple. I was 20 years old. What did I know? I had some photographic talent, and I had worked in a camera shop. So I knew that I could get a job in New York eventually, which I did. Ironically, about 6 months later, working for that same company, I went to Greenwich Village to play chess just at the time they were putting stages up and removing some of the tables. And when I asked them what was going on, they said, "We're going to have entertainment here." And I said, "Well, what do you have to do to qualify?" And they said, "Well, you come down and audition." So I did. I went down. I got accepted, and I started working in the village in early 1960. And by the time Peter and Mary and I went on the road, I had had 2 years of Greenwich Village and was pretty competent at doing everything from master of ceremonies to playing music to reading poetry to doing a little drama to being a stand-up comic. There was a little bit of everything involved in that wonderful community.
Well, how did you meet Peter and Mary?
Actually introduced to Peter by Mary. And Mary was introduced to Peter by Albert Grossman, our manager, who wanted to put together a trio. Felt that I'm not sure how he felt specifically about the Kingstons, but I know that he had and of course the Kingston Trio was there in place doing folk music before we were. But I think he wanted to bring the sensitivity and excitement of a woman vocalist like Mary with the humor and Midwestern affability of someone like me and the intensity, the beautiful tenor voice and academic perception of folk music that Peter had from his days at Cornell. You know, but you could talk about experiments like that, but they don't always turn out. It just happened that we really hit it off. We sang Mary Had a Little Lamb because it was the one song we could agree on the lyrics to. Everybody else had their own version of it, of every other folk song that there was. And we sang it, you know, Mary would sing the melody and Peter and I would harmonize. And then Peter would sing the melody and Mary and I would harmonize. And I would sing the melody and they would harmonize. And no matter which way we turned it around, it sounded good. So, you know, armed with that, we worked up 6 or 7 songs, and we all remember to this day the words that Albert said when he heard those 6 or 7 songs. He said, we got through, and he looked at us, he said, if nothing happens, you're going to happen. And in the village, what that meant was, if you don't blow this and throw it all away and do something stupid like not being able to handle it, I think that you have a successful life in front of you, and he certainly was right.
Well, that's certainly true from our perspective, too, as listeners. Having heard you in Bloomington about 3 or 4 years ago when you were in town, that you've changed parts a little bit, that it seems like Peter was singing the high part and Mary was singing the middle part and you were still doing the baritone. Am I reading that incorrectly?
Musically, I probably have the widest range of all. People have told me, professionals who have worked with my voice when I went through some bad times, in the late 80s, that I'm basically a tenor. So I really have quite a wide range. And if you play the first Peter Paul and Mary album, it has a song on it called Early in the Morning. And it's about an octave and a half, maybe 2-octave spread on the lead vocal that I sing there. But I think you're absolutely right. The roles have changed, but I don't think they've changed musically so much as they've changed philosophically, because to my way of thinking, Mary is the stand-up comic on stage now. And I'm probably incredibly, much more intense than I was in the early days of Peter, Paul, and Mary. And I think Peter's much more affable than he used to be. You know, he writes those wonderful, embracing, let's all sing together songs that are just, where there's 2 points being made. Not only is the lyric moving, but the very act of singing it together is moving. So, you know, I think our roles have shifted somewhat, but then, you know, in any healthy relationship, they always do.
Well, you mentioned something about your voice. How have you kept it in such good shape for as much singing as you've done?
It's truly a gift. Maybe it's doing all those sound effects, you know, the imitations of automobiles and toilets and jet planes and things. I mean, maybe it's just, you know, the fact that I gave it an early workout in its young life, and also my spirit is good. I mean, I'm a happy guy, basically, and I'm a very optimistic guy, and stress doesn't get to me. Oddly enough, the reason that I had trouble with my throat in the late 80s was because my parents were in the process of passing away at that time. And they died within 8 days of each other, and it was a tough time for me, and I carried it all in my throat, you know. One of those, you know, macho dilemmas where you find yourself as a male not being able to cry with the ease of my wife, you know, who keeps saying, you know, you got to let that out. And so it was very difficult, and it showed up as polyps and Lots of trouble in my throat.
Well, you sound fine now.
Well, I feel so.
Are you considering continuing to perform both as an individual and as a group?
Well, I think we finally realized that we're always going to be Peter, Paul, and Mary. And as long as we give each other the respect and the individual freedom that we currently are, and the time off, I think we'll probably be Peter, Paul, and Mary until one of us can't stand up anymore. As Mary said, you know, there's no reason at all why 20 years from now we shouldn't be standing in front of the White House shaking our canes.
You know, we talked about Betty and her calling. What about, you have three daughters, right?
I have a eldest daughter who is Elizabeth, who has taken over the directorship of the Public Domain Foundation now and does consulting to quite a few nonprofit organizations, even though she is the mother of our first grandchild and quite busy there and devoted. She lives about an hour away. The twin daughters, who are 6 years younger, have very diverse lives. Anna is out on the West Coast completing maybe third, fourth, fifth film project out there. She's been living out there for 4 or 5 years, so this is the time when all of her training is paying off, and she's having a glorious, wonderful time. Probably the closest thing to the same experience I had when I was in Greenwich Village. She's very enthralled with her work, and she's a very deep and a spiritual person who brings to my way of thinking such honor and respect to the role of acting. I just see a glorious, wonderful life for her out there, though, you know, she is removed many miles away, but the remaining daughter is going to be removed even further because she's going to Baku, which is the largest city in Azerbaijan, to be, how shall I say, to give feet to her wanderlust. She has had a remarkably successful career, and she's not even 30 years old yet. She went from an intern as an advertising in an advertising agency in the small town of Blue Hill, Maine. She then went to Atlanta. She went from Atlanta to New York. She went from New York to the A&E Channel, where she was director of advertising, was, you know, handling multimillion dollar budgets. Then she became a partner in the very same firm that she started off as an intern in Blue Hill. And finally, she said, but wait, I've always wanted to be a camp counselor. I've always wanted to run a camp. So she took over a camp in Maine for an entire summer, did a wonderful job. And she said, but wait, I've always wanted to see the world. So, you know, you just gotta stand back in amazement. It's a different life. You know, when you... I'm extrapolating here. You know, I don't know if we were raised exactly the same, but when I was brought up, somehow by the age of 22 or 23, you wanted to have the job, and you'd be looking for the woman you were going to settle down with. And I don't know, life was so much more serious and confined to parameters. And I don't know if they were socially, because they were, you know, socially ordained. You know, maybe it was just a lack of imagination, but I am just so astounded and delighted in Kate's appetite for seeing and understanding the world, learning languages, and having that kind of global experience that, you know, has really only lately been available to us as human beings. I mean, 50 years ago, to be able to do something like this was truly the domain of a 93-year-old woman who would sail on the Titanic, you know. But here's a 29-year-old woman, you know, passport, an incredible amount of talent in just about any area she wants to place it, and she's off to see the world.
Isn't that wonderful?
It is.
It makes you feel good, doesn't it?
It does.
If you were to make a wish list for your life, or your family, or the world, what would it be?
Well, you know, if you add the world, then I have a wish list. You know, the family, I'm everything I wish for is happening. You know, they are encouraged, they are eager, they are happy, they are hungry. They have their painful moments, but they share them, you know, they grow through them, they understand them. They are not defeated or overwhelmed by them. I can't wish for anything better than that, because to me, life, you know, is a kind of an ongoing attitude. It's not really any destination you arrive at. It's more or less a continual process of being connected, not only to the people and the world around you, but with the larger sense of the gift of life and being thankful. There's very few ways in which we can have a dialogue with God that don't include thankfulness. And, you know, I'm just so pleased that my children have learned that. But for the world, my heart pines that we should speak a similar language of love. I know that we will not, speak the same words, and we don't always understand, but that we should grow into an arena of trust, and that, truly the second coming, as the Jewish people see it, is the arrival of this peace in the world and understanding. And I join them, in the prayer for that arrival.
What more could we ask than to end with those thoughts?
Yeah.
Our guest today has been Noel Paul Stuckey, performer, composer, father, husband, techno wizard, and the Paul of Peter, Paul, and Mary. Noel, this has been a real delight.
Oh, thank you, Bob.
We enjoyed having you with us.
Thank you. Enjoyed being here. God bless you.
Do you mind if we finish with the Irish blessing?
Would seem appropriate. It's what I do at my concerts.
Well, let's do it. This is Bob Willard. Thank you for listening.
May the road rise to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face. The rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand, and may God hold you.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in January of 2001. Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash. For WFIU, thanks for listening.